It seems like there was a lot of money put into a bunch of these different software wallet providers to compete against MetaMask because they saw the success of Consensus.
Hello, and welcome to The Crypto Brief, a podcast from the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Every week, we get together to discuss current events and trends in blockchain technology, tokenization, DeFi, NFTs, mining, and related aspects of the crypto ecosystem. I'm your co-host, Ryan Stubbe, Director of Bitcoin Mining, and I'm joined by Jason Ward, Head of the Blockchain Incubator, Parth Gargava, Product Architect within Fidelity Labs, and Jack Newrider, Research Analyst with Fidelity Digital Assets. Before we begin, just a friendly reminder that this discussion is for educational purposes only and should not be viewed as investment advice or a recommendation for any security or asset. The views expressed are those of the co-hosts and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. As we all know, digital assets are speculative and highly volatile and are only for those investors with a high risk tolerance. So let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hey, y'all. Morning.
Morning.
Hey, Ryan.
How are you?
Doing well.
I'm back.
Refreshed?
Yeah. I'm back and feeling refreshed.
Good to see you.
Jason and I swapped roles today. He won't be joining us.
On a scale of 0 to 100, how unplugged were you able to be from crypto markets?
I would say this is probably the most unplugged I've been since I started working in crypto, if I'm being completely honest. So I guess to put a number around it, maybe like an 85, I wasn't able to completely unplug, but I was unplugged enough.
That's how you know it's a bear market.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Honestly, it's a good thing that you unplugged now because this week was really low on news. So yeah. There was barely anything happening.
Yeah, I literally had my head in the sand. So there you go. All right. I think we can jump in. So, Parth, you mentioned it was a little bit of a slow week last week, but there are a couple of things that we wanted to talk about today. First off, we're gonna talk a little bit about wallets and some of the activity that we've seen on that front. And that also ties in with the last week I tried. And then we're going to jump over to, some news that we've seen out of Binance related to their management of customer funds and the collateral reserves for some of their native tokens. And then we're going to close it out by talking a bit about some news out of Amazon related to NFTs. So with that, Parth, you want to walk us through with what you tried last week, and then we can kind of dovetail that into a little bit more about wallets.
Sure, sounds good. So this is an interesting one. So last week I tried this social wallet and messenger called Tribes, tribes.xyz. And it's a messenger where you can send messages to folks as long as you have their wallet address or their ENS. And you can also create co-wallets or tribes to get shared ownership. So let me sort of dig deeper. So within crypto, when you think about communication tools, so you have Discord, you have Telegram, but these are two separate from where the actual action happens, right? So if I typically I communicate with folks on Discord or Telegram, but then I have to go to a different avenue, such as Uniswap or Tally or somewhere else, to make the real decisions. And so here's the difference with tribes, right? So if I have a group with Ryan and Jack, and I wish to vote whether we should buy a Bored Ape, right? So then we can do that on the application, and I can have a proposal to vote based on the tokens we have. Or if I wish to actually buy the ape, then I can simply copy and paste the contract address. And within the application, I'm going to see that this contract is a legitimate address, which belongs to Bored Ape on ETH. So that's kind of the idea, right? So it's more, so that's one part of it. Or tomorrow, if we decide to also include Jason in the group, we can ask him to buy a specific NFT, and only then can he be part of our tribe. So that's kind of the idea.
So technically speaking, Parth, how does this differ from a multi-sig wallet? And also, how does it differ from your traditional DAO?
That's a really good question because it's basically a marriage of both. So it's a typical DAO, which operates on multisig within a small application on the phone. So think about a Telegram, but super crypto native, right? So what's more is that you can have a tribe, which can also have a shared wallet. So kind of like exactly what you said, you could have a multisig wallet within your tribe, and then you can make purchases or investments. So that's kind of the core idea.
So the base layer is like communication, and then there's a layer on top of that that can kind of custody funds or be used to execute financial transactions on behalf of the tribe, basically, right?
That's correct. Yes. And I think, in my opinion, that's how the DAOs would function in the future. It's just going to be a group of people who know each other, but they just wish to exchange value. And so this would be a really typical example of a friend circle just having a shared wallet and also communicating about crypto, but then also making the app action happening on the app.
In terms of usability, one of the things we always talk about with wallets varying natures, how usable is it? Or even with some of these DAOs, right? Like, how do you interact with them? What does the user experience look like?
So I think the UX is pretty slick. And so what I want to do is I want to quickly talk about the history of wallets, because I know all three of us have had different experiences of using wallets. But when you think about historic wallets, you had paper wallets, right, where you could move your mouse to add randomness. And that's when you had a public private key generated to store your Bitcoin. Then I think around 2017 is when you had Mew or My Ether wallet. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
So My Ether wallet was basically this website, which was a wallet, but it could support only the decentralized applications listed on the website. So I remember using Maker, you could use Compound, and then six or seven others, right? And then you had MetaMask, right, which kind of blew competition. So the idea of MetaMask was make a really simple, small browser extension, and then any application, any decentralized application can use MetaMask, and that's all you need, right? So that's kind of, that's the history of wallets. But just in terms of UX, I think a lot of new wallets are coming out. And I personally believe that the next year or two are going to be sort of the wallet wars, where you would have these incumbents trying to innovate, but then you will have smaller companies that are going to bring new technology in wallets, better key management to scale this to mainstream folks. So it's not just going to be tech enthusiasts, but also folks who don't care about blockchain, but they still want to leverage the benefits of crypto.
Yeah, Partha, I was just going to say that phrase, wallet wars. It seems like there was a lot of money put into a bunch of these different software wallet providers to compete against MetaMask because they saw the success of Consensus. And now you see, I mean, there's like a million of them. You couldn't list them all, but Trust Wallet has a browser extension now. XDeFi, Rainbow, Phantom, there's like a million of them.
How do we feel like people will be incentivized to move away from MetaMask to some of these other providers?
That's again, a really good question, because essentially for wallets, you don't have any sort of hard stickiness, right? So you have muscle memory, which is that I know how to use a browser extension wallet. And so if I use MetaMask, I might as well use Phantom. I might as well use something else, right? And so I think the innovation is going to come just from UX and tech upgrades like EIP4337. So I know I keep raving about account abstraction, which I think is the next big thing. And it's still under the radar, but I think it's going to be picked up really soon. But yeah, I think that's what's going to really make the change.
Wait, and for the less technical in the crowd, can you explain what that is exactly?
Yeah, sure. So the idea of account abstraction is that you can have smart wallets, right? So which means that you can actually add logic to your wallets. So let me give you an example. So I can code my wallet in such a way that if I get money from Ryan, I should automatically put that in our shared wallet, right? Or if Jack sends me a Pudgy Penguin, I basically say, just give it to Jason directly without my interaction. So that's account abstraction, which means you could add logic in such a way that, hey, this wallet is the serious one, so I'm just going to interact with five protocols, or this wallet is just for NFTs, and so I should not be able to interact with any other protocol. So I think you would also see more built-in security as account abstraction gets more mainstream, right? Because a lot of times people fall prey to phishing attacks or just bad URLs. And so if I can specify, or if I can whitelist protocols that I wish to interact with, then that's just better UX and more security.
So ultimately, it's instead of having your assets held by like an externally owned account, your assets are held by a smart contract. Mm-hmm. Right?
That's correct.
And then you could code in different things that could, you know, that could feasibly happen. Probably a lot of them, you know, we couldn't even think of currently, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so Let me give you one simple use case, which I think is going to be really useful, right? So if you've ever used Uniswap, or if you've added liquidity on Uniswap, you basically have to sign a transaction four times. First, you approve the token transfer, then you actually do the token transfer, then you stake whatever you want, whatever liquidity you want to add. And so with account abstraction, you can batch them together. So one single click and I can do exactly what I need to do. So it's just so much better UX. And I think even for MetaMask, I think it's a great product. But I know I was mentioning this before, but I've been having a lot of issues with a lot of failed transactions. So like every 10th transaction or 9th transaction that I do just automatically fails for me. And I think I've seen a lot of people thinking about the same. So I can almost see that this industry is ripe for more innovation and just better UX. And so going back to your question, Ryan, about user stickiness and what's the incentive for users, this may be a super wacky thought. I don't know if this is going to be true or not, but you know how Phantom and MetaMask are just browser extensions? Mm-hmm. So the day these browsers like Apple or Google decide to make their wallets native, then it's going to be game over for a lot of other wallets.
Yeah, it's a different dimension in the wallet wars.
Yep, exactly.
So in terms of interoperability, I know we've talked kind of a lot about this, you know, in the context of wallets before, but, you know, as you said, MetaMask has been very popular, you know, amongst most users. You know, it has a lot of kind of interoperability across different protocols. If we start seeing like individual protocols build out their own wallets, what do you think the likelihood is that it's built, you know, built for purpose for that protocol, or is it built for multiple protocols? What I'm trying to get at is, you know, do we see people have multiple wallets across different protocols, which are optimized for that protocol, versus kind of the more centralized, you have a single wallet, you know, again, in the software sense, that you use, you know, across multiple protocols?
So that's exactly what's happening already. So you have Uniswap and Compound already working on their own wallet. And the idea is that whenever I use MetaMask to do a simple Uniswap transaction, Uniswap is not making any of that spread. Like they don't get any of that extra money that MetaMask is making in terms of transaction fee. And so ideally these DeFi protocols like Uniswap or Compound would like to own the full stack, right? So if you think about Solana, for example. I don't know if you guys saw, but they have a Solana Saga phone. Do you guys remember that? So they basically wish to own the entire stack, like from the app store to wallet creation to all the transactions, which in theory is, I think it's a cool idea. I don't know if it's going to actually become mainstream, but the idea is that whenever users use wallets which are outside of the protocols are not making any of that money. Mm-hmm. Which ideally they would like to. So that's why you would see a bunch of these really established DeFi protocols also venture into new wallets.
Okay, so I guess the incentive for the different protocols is they're able to capture more of the spread of some of these transactions, and the benefit for the user, better performance, maybe lower fee.
Yeah, you can, from the protocol's perspective, better monetize the user and sort of capture them throughout the entire life cycle of using their application, right?
Yep. Yeah. I guess the question then is like, what does that do for the user experience, right? Like, are you now managing multiple wallets with multiple keys, and like, what does that look like? Because I could see a scenario where then you have another layer that comes in, right? And it's like an aggregator of wallets, right? Where you can kind of plug into each of those individual things and kind of manage all of your holdings from one central.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the biggest issues for like anyone trying to make a wallet that competes against MetaMask or Trust Wallet, or the handful of wallets that sort of have the like Pareto market share, the 80% market share, is that like by default, if you're building any sort of new application or you have an existing one, like you want to integrate with the largest wallets, because then automatically the largest, you know, users have an easy onboard experience to use your application. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you don't support MetaMask and I'm a MetaMask user and it's some small application, I'll just go find the competitor that does support it. And so that's sort of like a hard, like there are really strong network effects there, I think, that do create a good amount of stickiness. Although, of course, the story's far from written in terms of where wallets go from here.
Yeah, I think I'm looking for maybe a wallet, which is almost a, it's not exactly a super app, but which lets you customize a lot of things. Like I know there's a wallet, and I know Jack, you like this one, XDeFi. So I've been thinking about, so they've, on their feature roadmap, they're also thinking of estate planning, which means that if I have a kid or a spouse, I can delegate my money to them. And if I do not do a single transaction for 5 years, then that my portfolio automatically goes to them, right? So these are the features which people are thinking about, and that's all enabled after account abstraction goes live. And yeah. So you're almost thinking about one wallet, which lets you do a bunch of things instead of just doing simple transactions.
And that's just, so it's, I guess, worth noting that this is all really on the software wallet side right now, right? And then you also have the hardware wallet side of things, which obviously different kind of purpose there. But I think you'll also probably see the continued marrying of those two things, right? Where you have the hardware wallet that talks to the software wallet. So you can have the security that you traditionally, the additional security you traditionally have with hardware wallets, with the convenience of the software wallet. And I know you mentioned like Apple and Google in the context of browsers, but they would also be really well positioned to do something on this front, you know, with the hardware side, given kind of their
absolutely
role in consumer electronics.
Is there a player currently, like for instance, Ledger in the hardware space, that also has a software wallet where you can sort of have a checking and savings account, so to speak, for like for your crypto? Does Trezor or Ledger, any of the big hardware wallets do that?
So I think they have direct integrations with MetaMask, and that's exactly what I use. So if I'm using my real money, like not the fun money, that I use it using my Ledger, and then if I have to do a transaction, I have to go connect it to my MetaMask. So you have these integrations, but they don't have their own software client.
This will be interesting to watch. I agree with you. Last year, we saw a lot of capital investments in these different projects. So, you know, obviously there's a significant delay, you know, from capitalization to like actually starting to see some innovation. But I think, you know, we will definitely see a lot of movement on this front over the next year or so. Parth, as you mentioned at the top, like we've had some interesting experience with wallets. You know, arguably the user experience has improved dramatically since we started playing around with these things 5 years ago. But I still think there's a lot of room for improvement, and it'll be really interesting to see kind of who enters the space and to your point, what the incumbents do in response to that, to kind of keep pace with the new entrants. So I think with that, let's transition over to the Binance story. So Parth, do you want to just give us an overview of what's happened there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So not to spread any sort of FUD, but this story was broken by Bloomberg. And here's sort of the gist of it, right? So Binance, which is obviously this big centralized exchange, they issue a ton of tokens on Binance Smart Chain, or BSC. So BSC, for those of you who do not know, it's another smart contract platform like Ethereum, but people typically use it since the transaction cost is really cheap, right? And so Binance issues these tokens that are called B tokens, or Binance pegged tokens, and there are close to 94 of them. So now, in order to issue one B token, Binance has to hold one actual token in the reserve, right? So if I give you an example, if I need to use one ETH on Binance Smart Chain, then Binance should have that one ETH on the Ethereum network locked, right? Because that's the corresponding mapping. And so here's the big problem. So it was uncovered that Binance was holding these tokens in a wallet called Binance 8, and that's the same exact wallet that also holds customer funds. Essentially, part of the Binance peg tokens were being collateralized by user funds, which isn't great. So that's kind of the story. And so Binance 8 holds close to 25% or $16 billion worth of assets in one single address, which is called Binance 8. And the problem is that the tokens issued on Binance were not backed one for one by Binance. And so this was kind of the red flag. This story broke out, and it's gotten a lot of traction. But what are your first thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been a great, you know, couple of months for Binance, and you know, adjacent to everything that's happened with FTX. I think, you know, one of the things that I immediately think about is, you know, Binance has obviously been a very vocal advocate of proof of reserves, right? Which, you know, many people are now advocating for that following, you know, some of the collapses that we've seen in the ecosystem. But I think one of the flaws of proof of reserves and why you're kind of hearing more and more people speak out criticizing the idea of proof of reserves is that it kind of paints a clear picture of half of the story, right? And the other half of the story, which is the liabilities or the claims on those assets, right? Like you don't really have great insight into, right? And so in this case, like, sure, you can see what a particular wallet holds, but it's really hard to trace, you know, those holdings again back to individual claims. So basically what belongs to who, right? What is meant to be collateralizing these tokens that are natively issued by Binance and what are, you know, client, you know, deposits, right? And so I think technically speaking, it's a really, you know, it's maybe a little bit easier to solve the proof of reserves problem. It's going to be much harder to solve the proof of liabilities problem and kind of marrying those two together so that you actually have, you know, like, you know, an airtight, I guess, audit, right, of what the current state of the holdings is.
It feels like that conversation that everybody was having back in like November, after all of the events sort of unfolded around lenders and FTX, of course, around pulling your assets off of exchanges and, you know, demanding more transparency and proof of reserves and attestations. The conversation kind of has gone away in the past few weeks. And it, to some degree, is, I don't know if that's correlated with price and sentiment or just the fact that a little bit of time has passed and then everybody just says, okay, let's go back to normal. But a lot of that conversation has seemed to stop. And if you look at the data on chain, like withdrawals from exchanges for Bitcoin, they stopped. Actually, we saw positive inflows over the past like week or two, if you look at the more recent updated data. And so like there has been net withdrawals since those events have happened, but like now we've reached another equilibrium. That conversation around more transparency and proof of reserves has kind of faded into the background for the time being because there aren't companies that are going under right now, at least in the past month or so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like any other like market event, right? Like there's a huge flight to safety. And then as the market, to your point, like finds an equilibrium and is able to kind of survey the risks that exist, right? Like, and I think the risks in this case was like who's going under and who's not. And like in those early days following the collapse of FTX, I think there were a lot of open questions where now even surrounding, you know, what's happened, there's a lot more clarity, you know, and a lot more information has become available. So I think people are able to survey the risk associated with having funds on any given exchange.
Yeah. I just feel like, you know, are people getting too lax too quickly? And we haven't really seen any full audits with proof of liabilities and assets shown by a lot of large exchanges. And so we just kind of the community rolled over and it's just like, okay, let's keep moving on. But
yeah.
The fear is, did we learn anything and has the industry truly changed, or do we face those types of events after the next run up or in the future?
Mazars deleted like all crypto reports on their website. So it wasn't really a Binance thing. It was more Mazars. But I do want to...
Well, that because they recognized how complex this is, mm-hmm. right? And if you make an attestation that, you know, these funds exist, again, like it's not the full picture. And I think the big concern is that the perception associated with like proof of reserves, it's okay, you know, this proof of reserves attestation has happened, my funds are safe, right? And like, that's not really true. And I think they recognize the risks associated with putting something out that's not fully baked.
Yeah. And I do want to quickly... I almost find this pattern, but November 25th is when Binance came out with this blog saying that Binance holds all of its client assets in segregated accounts, which are fully separate from any accounts used by Binance or that belong to Binance. So this is what came out on November 25th. December 7th is when they put out the proof of reserves report with Mazars. Then Jan 10th, Bloomberg sort of reported that Binance has had trouble managing stablecoin reserves. And so then you had a lot of on-chain forensics, which actually showed that BUSD, which is Binance's stablecoin, was not always fully collateralized, right? So they've had a lot of flaws. And then this, right? So then you have Binance 8, which is also using customer funds, but also being used as a collateralized asset for tokens on Binance Smart Chain. Yeah. So I guess the question is, and some of you may ask, hey, what's the worst case scenario here, right? So, and I think the answer is, if there are huge issues on Binance Smart Chain potentially, then the worst case scenario is that Binance holders with funds in their wallet would not be able to withdraw in case if the amount falls significantly on BSC.
I feel like there's been like a desensitization to some of these issues, right, recently. But it'll be interesting to watch. Has there been any official response from Binance on this yet?
Yeah. So they actually owned up, right? They owned their mistake. So they basically said that we realized that this was a mistake and we'll be working on it.
Yeah.
So they officially acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think anyone should mix it up. No one's rooting for Binance to fail here.
Right. No.
We're just sort of trying to beat the drum of more transparency.
As one of the largest,
Yeah, 60-70% of spot volume. Yeah,
right. I mean, they're kind of on an increasingly empty field, and so obviously more and more of the spotlight is going to be on them and what they're doing. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think the fact that they've owned up to it and they've acknowledged that it's happened and that they're correcting it is a good thing. And, you know, you can only kind of hope for a quick resolution in this case. All right. And I know we only have a few minutes left here. So, Jack, do you want to quickly take us through the NFT story?
Yeah. So I'll talk about Amazon for a minute, but I think the more interesting story is what was going on over the weekend with Bitcoin and rare digital collectibles, ordinals. The news story around Amazon was just that Blockworks put out a report that there were, I think, four or five unnamed sources that said that Amazon is supposedly working on some NFT initiative expected to take place in the spring. They've had a group that's been supposedly thinking about how to enter the blockchain space or capitalize on some of this growth, mostly centered around gaming and related NFT applications. They signed a deal with Ava Labs, the builders of the Avalanche blockchain, a couple of weeks ago. AWS signed that, sorry. But this is Amazon, not just AWS, that is supposedly involved in this NFT initiative. So, you know, large e-commerce marketplace, centralized, but maybe kind of an interesting story to continue to follow. We kind of have seen these large tech companies have rumors around partnering with Polygon and doing stuff with NFTs or, you know, whatever it may be. But this is just sort of another one with Amazon supposedly getting into NFTs. And then I don't know if anyone has any comments there, but...
No, I think the only thing I would add is just... This is maybe some positive news, right? I feel like in the recent weeks, all we've kind of been hearing is, you know, large companies, you know, exiting the space or pausing their kind of exploration efforts around digital assets broadly or scaling back, right? And of course the wave of layoffs that we've seen. So it's I guess a little bit refreshing to see, you know, a larger company actually continuing to do the work that they're doing in the space. I would hope that we'll kind of continue to see that despite market cycle, what's happening in the market. We're still going to start to see more people building, more people entering the space. So I think it's a positive. And there's not a lot of information around it. So TBD, and we'll certainly monitor it moving forward.
Yeah. And then a last second story. Over the weekend, there was a lot of discussion about from core developers of something called ordinal theory that's being used to basically uniquely identify Satoshis and then sort of tie them back to digital collectibles. And so you can have effectively what amounts to something like an NFT. There are 277 in existence as of now, and maybe we can do a little bit more research mechanically on how these work for next week or for an upcoming episode if it keeps being a topic of discussion. But a number of developers were talking about basically how these are eating up block space and how maybe that miners should censor these transactions because what is Bitcoin really about? I guess it's sort of the core ethos of Bitcoin and whether or not it's only about just having Bitcoin, which this doesn't actually mint a new token or anything. It just identifies these Satoshis, but they take up more block space because of some of the information encoded in the transactions. But it's an interesting story.
Jack, what's your take? Are you gonna buy a Bitcoin NFT?
I'll have to see where they go. We'll have to see what the floor price is. I don't know how you'd have to create some sort of a centralized marketplace for these things, right? Yep. I don't even know how they're trading right now.
You're going to continue to see like this push-pull, right, of the kind of Bitcoin maximalists who believe in like pretty fundamentally in Satoshi's vision, and kind of this other wave that's happening of people trying to innovate on Bitcoin and do different things. I think tokenization is a great example. And obviously I would say this falls underneath that umbrella with Taro and, you know, some of the other like layer two tokenization projects that we've seen on top of Bitcoin. Like that could potentially be very interesting and valuable for the Bitcoin ecosystem. But I guess it's really just a question about like what your beliefs are and what your vision for Bitcoin long-term is.
We talked about it before this recording about how if doing something like this took an actual upgrade to Bitcoin's base layer, well, it would never happen.
We'll be retired when that happened. Yeah.
Yeah. We would be retired, right? Yeah. By the time that happens. But it would never happen. But instead now, and that's why you hear a lot of the discussion around things like potentially stable coins on Lightning or Taro and using like layer twos or side chains to have stable coins or NFTs and digital collectibles. It's because then you don't actually have to change or tamper the existing code because that would take so much collective buy-in. You would need the whole Bitcoin maximalist camp that thinks that there should only be Bitcoin and nothing else.
It was funny to see how like a lot of Bitcoin maximalists were talking about like how this is against the ethos of Bitcoin and this is not what Satoshi wanted. And some were actually, they went on to say that let's just do a fork and have the NFT on a separate chain. So, and I think the whole idea of Bitcoin is that it's permissionless and censorship resistant, so you could do whatever you want.
Yeah. And what's the biggest piece of FUD that people have been talking about in the last like 6 months? Ever since Ethereum moved to proof of stake, it's that fees for Bitcoin in the future won't be high enough in order to suffice for adequate security and decentralization for miners to get paid because the block subsidy reduces over time. You lower your inflation rate and you become reliant on fees, but fees have never materially picked up throughout Bitcoin's history to actually pay for miners realistically at the moment. And so over time, like what could pay for it? Well, you need demand for block space. And maybe that just comes because we only have whatever 100 million users today and there's going to be billions in the future. Okay, that's one avenue. Or what if there's other innovation like this? And so the irony is that these core developers are sort of pushing back against what would be, you know, driving block space demand potentially. Again, it's like it was just a fad over the weekend. Maybe it burns out or maybe it becomes something, but we'll be following it, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, definitely interesting. All right, guys. Well, thanks for an interesting conversation. I think there's a kind of a lot to look forward to, and things we'll be watching closely moving forward. Thanks everyone for joining, and we'll see you next week. Have a good rest of your week.
Digital assets are speculative and highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and are only for those investors willing to risk losing some or all of their investment and who have the experience and ability to evaluate the risks and merits of an investment. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or any third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated based on the information available at the time and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2023 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.